Okay. You know what we're going to do, everybody, is we're gonna try to get you out of here a little early. We'll try to finish before noon.
Okay,
I'm going to start on page 92. It says on page 92, about one paragraph down, it says, if you are satisfied he is a real alcoholic, begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of the malady. Show him from your own experience how the queer mental condition surrounding the first drink prevents normal functioning of willpower. I love this. If you are convinced he's a real alcoholic, again, I think we're to be at a place where we can be a maximum benefit to God and God's children. But what's incumbent upon us is being available for the still sick and suffering alcoholic. That takes precedence over anything else. So I need to become convinced that the individual is an alcoholic. How do I do that? I talk about the mental obsession, the physical allergy, and the unmanageability of alcoholism, and I tell that through my own story. I want to tell of an experience I had that worked out so good. I should have known it was going to work out great, but here's what it was. I got a call from one of my ex-wives this one time. I love that. One of my ex-wives, right? We are not saints. Anyway, ain't that for sure?
Hell yeah.
Okay.
I'll second
so
that
anyway,
one.
I get a call. I get a call from one of my ex-wives, and she goes, "Listen, my brother is in trouble. My brother is in Hackettstown Hospital. He's dying of alcoholism. It's really a mess. Can you help him?" So I go, "Okay." I find out a little bit about what's going on. He's been just drinking. I knew he was an alcoholic back in the 70s, you know? I mean, you know, because this guy, all three brothers from this wife's family were unbelievably alcoholic.
It was just she married you.
Yeah. I looked like home, you know, when she saw me. Oh, I'm going to marry this guy. This looks familiar. Anyway, so I go, look, I'm going to do this old school. I'm going to do this, you know, like in the first 5 years of AA. Here's what I did. I found out what room he was in, and I called up about 12 of my guys. And I said, all right, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go in, you're going to be at 2 o'clock, and you're going to stay till 3, and you're going to tell this individual your story. If he wants to talk, that's fine, but the main thing is you need to tell your story. And then I had somebody come in at 4, and then I had somebody come in at 6, then I had somebody come in at 8. I had 12 guys lined up to go in and tell their story. This is how they used to do it in the old days. In the old days, they would put you in the hospital even if you didn't need to be in the hospital, and they'd do it for two reasons. One of them, to show you how much trouble you're in medically, and the other was to get a captive audience for the 12-step calls. Okay, so by the time the ninth guy came in, and started to tell his story. He called me up. He goes, okay, stop sending these guys. Stop sending. I'm in, okay? I'm a member. And as soon as he got out of the hospital, you know, he was our coffee maker. He became a home group member, like that. I mean, he felt so appreciative of all these different people coming in, not wanting anything from him, but wanting to share their experience, strength, and hope with him. And, that worked out so well. When I pay attention to how they did it back in the day, when I pay attention to the actual black part instructions of this book, really, really good things can happen. I just love to outthink this stuff and say, well, we've learned a lot more and there's different ways to do it. No, go back to these basics and apply these principles for a couple of reasons. One of them is it works. The other is when you change this stuff and you do it differently, you're taking on a grave responsibility. Mm-hmm. You know, you're now responsible for the results. If you just do what's in this book, you can basically say, I did it the AA way, you know, and if they die, they die. If you change all this around, you try to do it your way and you get your hands in there and you muck it all up, you can be responsible for somebody dying. I do not believe the statement that if somebody's ready, there's nothing you can do wrong, and when somebody's not ready, there's nothing you can do right. I don't believe that statement at all. We can kill people by doing things wrong on our 12-step calls. Absolutely. And you know what? If they're not ready, we can make them ready to get ready. you know, that's basically our job. Talk about alcoholism. Speak of it as an illness, a fatal malady. Talk about the conditions of body and mind which accompany it, the mental obsession, the unmanageability. Keep his attention focused mainly on your personal experience. Explain that many are doomed who never realize their predicament. Doctors are rightly loath to tell an alcoholic patient the whole story unless it will serve some good purpose. And most of the time, the doctor's not really well qualified to do that. You know, doctors look for specific symptoms and then appropriately treat for those specific symptoms. When we have a spiritual malady, how do you appropriately treat for that? You know what I mean? A lot of times they'll see a psychotic episode and they won't really understand. It's the guy's in the middle of detoxing or something, you know, and they'll label it something that it isn't. It's actually situational. They'll label it as something clinical, and you know, you can get into trouble. So this is one of the reasons why it's a real good idea for us to be involved, or for you to send people, you know, for the medical attention they need to a place that understands alcoholism. You will soon have your friend admitting he has many, if not all, of the traits of the alcoholic. And that's good. When they start to talk to you, you know, you're setting the hook. On page 93, tell him exactly what happened to you. Stress the spiritual feature freely. You know, they used to say, don't talk about God, you'll drive him away. Listen, if the mention of God is going to drive somebody away, alcohol is powerful enough to bring him back in, you know. You got to do it with tact and common sense, though. You can't be like an evangelical, you know. You got to have God. You got to use it. You got to do it with tact and common sense. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If a man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic that he does not have to agree with your conception of God. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. The main thing is that he be willing to believe in a power greater than himself and that he live by spiritual principles. This is a piece that you need to be able to sell. Spiritual principles, power greater than themselves. If you've done the explanation of the first step well, you know, it's not going to be out of the question to start to understand that there's a power greater than yourself that can restore you to sanity. Otherwise, how are you even standing there? You know what I mean? If you're admitting that you had all the traits of the alcoholic, and this individual is talking about they have all the traits of the alcoholic, how are you standing there sober? How are you standing there recovered? You need to be able to explain that. That it's living life along spiritual principles, gaining access to a power greater than yourself. You know, we need to talk about this. Everybody thinks we need to avoid God. That's a wrong way to look. That's a wrong way to look. We need to be telling the truth to people. Alcoholics Anonymous is unapologetically about gaining access to the power of God. I know a lot of people don't like that. I know a lot of fellowship members try to avoid it. I know a lot of literature tries to skirt it. But the fact of the matter is if you're alcoholic, there is only, your only hope is gaining access to a power greater than yourself, because you are powerless on your own unaided will. Explaining this with tact and common sense to the prospect who's sitting there, you know, your main focus on the 12-step call, I think is very, very important. When dealing with such a person, you better use everyday language to describe spiritual principles. There's no use arousing any prejudice he may have against certain theological terms or conceptions, which he already may be confused. He already may not be confused. He may know more about, you know, religious theology than you do. He may be thinking, you know, who's this guy talking to me? I've got a doctor of divinity, for God's sake. I've sponsored some priests. you basically need to talk about, it's about gaining access to that power greater than yourself, not being able to describe the attributes or the theology of. It's about the practical application of gaining access to that power greater than yourself. You know, there are certain, you know, listen, you could have some of the earlier Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, you could have had been a phone booth if it wasn't for the clergy that was showing up in AA. You know, a lot of those Catholic priests tipped a little bit, you know. You may belong to a religious denomination. Again, that's not necessarily even something that you need to bring up. But you do have to explain to them that to be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. Mm-hmm. That's what our faith is built on. By self-sacrifice and unselfish constructive action. And you can explain, that's part of what I'm doing right here, right now. You know, there's nothing I want from you. This is an expression of my self-sacrifice and my unselfish constructive action. Let them see that you're not there to instruct them in religion. Call to his attention the fact that however deep his faith and knowledge, he could not have applied it or he would not drink. That's the thing. We have a faith that works, and it's built on the self-sacrifice. It's built on working with others. Our faith is strong enough to keep us protected from alcohol. You know, many people have a very, very strong faith, but because of the way they act and the way they apply their faith, it doesn't protect them against alcoholism or drug addiction. There's certain things that you need to do. Perhaps your story will help him see where he has failed to practice the very precepts he knows so well. You want to take over top of 94.
So here's the thing. This is still all in the first conversation you're having with the alcoholic, and I want to stress this. I mean, this is a conversation. This might be a marathon conversation. You know, and sometimes it's over a period of time. And this book says, well, this is in the first talk. I mean, I might have had this, you know, first conversation 3 or 4 times before somebody was willing to sit down and actually have an honest conversation with me. I love this. It says, you know, not to talk down from a spiritual hilltop. Never talk down to an alcoholic from any moral or spiritual hilltop. Simply lay out a kit of spiritual tools for his inspection. Show him how they worked with you. Offer him friendship and fellowship. And tell him that if he wants to get well, you'll do anything to help. So this is really important. I mean, that's part of the reason why, you know, look, you know, I'm highly educated. I've read tremendous amounts of spiritual literature. I'm actually well-versed in philosophy. I'm well-versed in theology. I'm well-versed in a heck of a lot of things, including social science. And when I talk in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I don't use clinical terms. I don't use theological terms. I use everyday language because I think it's really important, because people need to be able to understand what I'm saying. And they also need to not be threatened. You know, like, it's hard enough to be shake, rattling, rolling, dying an alcoholic death and lost. You know, and then you have somebody talking about, you know, all these deep, tremendous theological, philosophical ideas, and they're just looking at you going like, dude, I just don't want to, like, you know, spit in the mirror today, and I kind of want to stop throwing up. Like, that's as far as I've gotten. So it's important to do that. So it's important to make sure that this person really understands that you are in their shoes. And that's why that, you know, we let them talk about themselves. We talk about ourselves. It depends on how that conversation goes. First, sometimes it's me talking about where I was at and what happened with me. Sometimes I allow people to kind of run their mouths, set the bear traps, and then I start talking. It's a dynamic thing. And this is where the sixth sense is incredibly important. And, you know, the book tells us that we're going to get the sixth sense. We're going to get intuition. Listen to it. I don't know how many times I'd be talking to somebody, and I get really quiet, and I close my eyes. I take this deep breath, and then something comes out of my mouth. Because what I'm really saying is, God, what the hell do I say to that one? Uh-oh, what do I say? And then all of a sudden, boom, it comes. I'm like, wow, I didn't know I knew that. You know, if he's interested in your solution, you know, and if he expects you to act as a banker for his financial difficulties or a nurse for his sprees, you may have to drop him unless he changes his mind. He may do this after he gets hurt some more. It is not my job to deprive you of your bottom. It is my job to give you a kit of spiritual tools. That was a little Freudian there. But if he sincerely wants what, you know, is interested and wants to see you again, ask him to read this book. See, that's one of the instructions I don't do. Because here's the thing, is I read this book with them. I'll give them a chapter to read. I'll say, please read Bill's story and come back to me. You know, because if I send them off to read this book, Alcoholics for Procrastinators, a lot of times, like, you know, I never hear from them again. So we read this book together. That's a little tiny. I know we're not supposed to change the big book, and I told you I'm a fundamentalist and stuff like that, but that's the only thing I do differently in terms of a newcomer. You know, is I give them the book. I say, well, you know, read Bill's story. I want you to underline everything you identify with and with how Bill thought, drank, and felt, and come back. And then, you know, usually on the second meeting, they leave on their fourth step. That's kind of how it works with me. You know, and it talks about, and I love this, if he thinks he could do the job in any other way, he prefers some other spiritual approach, encourage him to follow his conscience. We have no monopoly on God, and that is the God's honest truth. I was trying to tell you that, you know, the big book is like the McDonald's of spiritual experience. It is not the only game in town. It's the only game in town for me in my experience. My experience is all I have to offer. I am not going to argue philosophical, theological concepts with you. That is not my job. That is above my pay grade. You know, what I'm here to do is share my experience, tell you about what I did to get better, and guide you along that process. I am not here to save your soul. I am not here to convince you of anything. You know, but point out that we alcoholics have much in common, that if you would like, in any case, you'd be friendly and let it go at that. And that is the truth. I'll tell you something really funny. Bernardsville had like a 10th anniversary, like a handful of years ago, right? And there was like this speaker who came in. He's like, I'm a big fan. So, of course, whenever he's in town, like I show up like, you know, like a puppy dog and listen and lap it up. So I brought a bunch of my sponsees down, right? And I had been living in another section of Jersey. And I come into this meeting and I look around and there's, you know, it's a full, it's like standing capacity. And I look around and I realize that about 25 of the women in the room at one point I had sponsored. Handful of them, you know, told me to, you know, to eat shit and die when I said things like, you know, all, you know, when I said, can you consider? And they're like, no, eat shit and die. Good luck. See you later. And a handful of them I had continued to work with and they had gone through amends and were, you know, had gone, and I'm much like Chris, I don't bring people through the steps multiple times. I want them to have a new experience because I'm limited, I'm human, I only know what I know, and I don't want to handicap you by my handicaps. I'm not that egotistical that I feel like I have to have some claim on your spiritual life. So a lot of times, you know, I'll go through the work with somebody and they're off and they're in the fellowship of the spirit and we'll run into each other and some people I keep in contact with, some I didn't. I'm looking in this room, there are 25 women at some point I had cracked a book with and they are still here 10 years later. How cool is that? How cool is that? I spoke at IckyPod 2 weeks ago and like a handful of women came up to me. I'm in Phoenix, Arizona. They're from all over the country, and they're like, you 12-step me, I was in your house meeting. I met a guy who had gotten sober in the Market Street Mission who had been 12-step on my husband's sponsee in the big book study that he got introduced to the big book was the big book study that my husband and his sponsee started in the Market Street Mission, which is still going to this day 10 years later. So this man was standing there in Phoenix, Arizona, in front of me because of a meeting that I had in my house and a sponsee of my husband's who had a great idea. 10 years later, this man is breathing today because of that. It has absolutely nothing to do with me and everything to do with God. So it says, don't be discouraged if your prospect doesn't respond at once. I've had people call me back years later and be like, oh, Facebook is beautiful. I love Facebook because I don't know how many times I've gotten a message in my inbox from somebody who maybe I sat down, I got through steps one, and I, you know, and we were starting to do some work, and they were like, dude, I'm not about this. I can't do it. Sorry. And I'm like, no problem, man. Good luck with it. No hard feelings. I have no invested interest in you doing this or not doing this because you are having an experience between you, God, and alcohol, and it's none of my business. All I am is a facilitator. So they've inboxed me on Facebook, and they're like, by the way, I'm ready. You want to help me, please? It's awesome. It's an incredible thing. So I'm not discouraged. I'm happy to talk to them. I'm happy to hang out, chill, talk with them, smoke after a meeting, you know. And a lot of times the funniest things, these women who have, you know, had a brush with the steps, but at some point they just petered out and went away, they'll send other people my way. They're like, yeah, I didn't want to do the steps with her because, like, man, she's really hardcore, but you need to do the steps with her. So all of a sudden, like, sponsees who have, like, you know, who have bailed or women that have bailed or whatever are now sending people, like, I can't help you because you're really crazy, but I know this lady. She's awesome. You need to work with her. I don't know how many times that has happened. You know, so we don't take it personally. You getting sober, you having experience with God has absolutely nothing to do with me and my ego. And if I'm attached to that, I'm doing you a disservice. Because, like I said, I've had plenty of people who told me to eat shit and die, but be happy to send people my way. You know, in fact, it's a joke. And when we lived in Warren County, New Jersey, there was a joke, and it was the funniest thing. One of my sponsees from out of town came in, and she had shown up at a meeting that I had been doing a big book study at for quite a while. And she was like, oh, you know, my sponsor's Carrie. And she had two reactions, which is, I hate that woman. And, oh, my God, I love her. And then there was this other one. I really love her, and she really helped me, but she scares the crap out of me. So there were, like, these three reactions. And my sponsee was like, what's with that? And I was like, well, that's part of what it is that how other people see me, whether you like me, is irrelevant to this process. I've sponsored women who hate my guts, but would call me if they were on fire. They don't have to like me. They have to trust me. You know, they know that I have a solution. They know that I have an answer. They know that I'm speaking from a place of God. Do they want to talk to me all the time? No. But they trust me with their lives. And that, for me, is good enough. You know, it goes on to talk about, you know, a second visit, right? And, you know, he's read this volume, is prepared to go through with the 12 steps of the program of recovery. Now, here's what I do, is I have that conversation. I qualify them. We talk about it. They qualify themselves. We discuss what it means to be an alcoholic. We describe all this stuff. And then I let them think about it. They're willing to sit down and do some work. They call me up and be like, Carrie, you know, I'm ready to do some work. I want to crack this book, right? We're on the second meeting. What I say to them is, are you willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcoholism? We talked about what alcoholism was. We talked about the hopeless feature. We talked about all these things. Are you willing to follow directions? Are you willing to go to any lengths? Yes. Okay. Let's crack the book. They come to my house. 3 hours later, they leave with a pen. Or sometimes they just sit in my garage and write their inventory. Depends on what's going on. You know, sometimes during a family party, that's been known to happen. At my daughter's graduation, my husband's sponsee was doing step work in one corner. My husband was doing 12-step in another quarter. I'm in the garage with three women. And my daughter's like, my mother asked my daughter where her mom was. You know, my daughter goes, oh, she's just helping those drunks in the garage again. That's what we do. It's a family thing. My daughter has done 12-step calls. I swear to God, I kid you not. My daughter's friend's mother said, I hear your parents have that meeting in their house and they help alcoholics. And my daughter goes, yeah, they, you know, my mom sits down and she reads this book with women and they get better and they're really happy. You might want to come down on a Wednesday night. No lie. My daughter's in fifth grade. She just did a 12-step call. Boom. It's awesome. But what it says here, and this is the thing, is that, you know, my husband and I, we take people into our house. We totally do. We do that. You know, because... Yeah, we have a Manny, we call him. but what we do is, like, we live in an area that really has a whole lot of, not a lot of treatment centers. In fact, my husband works for, like, the only one in, like, 30 square miles. People really don't have insurance. We live in an area, it's very rural. People don't have access to a whole lot of things. And so we get people, like, where, you know, we bring them to the emergency rooms, to the local hospital. We have them detox. We pick them up from the psych ward. They spend a week on our couch. They do some 12-step work, and we help place them in a, you know, sober living facility, or we help them get on their feet. So we're sort of an unofficial halfway house. We've been doing this, what? How long? Yeah, forever. 17 years? You know, because I really do believe that God, if God gave me a dollar, he wants me to give you 50 cents. We're poor, too. Like, we're not wealthy. We drive shitty cars. We have a five-bedroom house that is run down as all shit. And, you know, if I have a dollar, you get 50 cents. That's the way that I was taught to live. So we have to make that decision. Is we might take some people into our home, but we don't put our work on a service plane, meaning that if somebody's not... I am willing to go to any lengths for your recovery only if you are. I will meet your effort. I cannot do it for you, and I will not do it for you. So when you want me to do it for you, that's when I say, what are you willing to show me? So here it goes, and I said, we never avoid these responsibilities. To be sure that you're doing the right thing if you assume them, that's on page 97. Helping others is the foundation stone of our recovery. A kindly act once in a while is not enough. So patting somebody on the head in a meeting and giving them a cookie and saying it's going to be all right is not enough. It says you have to be willing to act the Good Samaritan in every day if need be. That might mean loss of many nights' sleep. Yes. Great interference with your pleasures. Guys, like, seriously? Okay, I have a tiny rant with this. I have a couple things. There are a couple little things I wanted to hit in this little section here. Okay. You ever meet the woman with the Prada purse, the perfectly dyed hair, the perfectly manicured nails, you know, the mani-pedi, you know, sitting in a meeting talking about her Lexus, telling you she doesn't have time to sponsor? Those are women I want to choke. For a couple reasons. One, me and my sponsees have to sponsor like 15 people at a time. Every moment of my waking life is doing some kind of 12-step in service, and like, I would like a night off, please. You know, so I kind of want to be like, you know, dude, God saved you from an alcoholic death. You work the steps. You have a solution. How selfish are you to sit in the rooms and be lazy with your one sponsee who's been on 9 for the past 15 years? You're too busy? You know, like, seriously? You know, like, we spend all this time fixing up the outside. I'm just going to speak for the women. I'm not going to talk for the men. We spend all this time fixing up the outside, having our wax vaginas and our freaking manicured nails and all this other shit, right? And inside, we're ugly as hell. Because we're not being of service. And we think if we can make the outside look pretty, that nobody will notice that there's nothing left inside. And I'll tell you what, the most beautiful women I've ever seen in the world are the women who are sitting down face to face, eyeball to eyeball, talking about God. They are the most beautiful creatures I have ever seen. So we spend all this time trying to project to the outside world this flawless, you know, I got to look like, you know, like the next supermodel, you know, Victoria's Secret. I'm in the gym 50 hours a week. Guess what? This is an amazing thing. I do a ton of 12-step work. I work out, totally, like 4 days a week. I do yoga. I run. I do other shit. You know, I'm a healthy person because my body's a temple, except for I do smoke. Somehow I think like that all the exercise I do and the vegetables I eat cancel out the smoking. I'm a little bit of a denial there. I'm totally with you on the delusion on that one. Totally know that. But here's my point. Here's my point on this one. Is I don't spend 37 hours in the gym. I don't have perfectly manicured nails. I don't have any of those things. And guess what? You know, I feel like a child of God, and I feel beautiful from the inside out. I don't have to polish the brass on the Titanic. So when we, you know, and the women are dying because there's nobody out there carrying this message with depth and weight. There's nobody willing to piss people off. I will piss you off. You could egg my fucking house. If you don't drink today, I did my job. I do not care if you like me. I don't even care if you respect me. But if I said something to you that helped to open up something inside of you that changed your life, then I did my job today. Because that's what I am here for. I am not here for a popularity contest. I'm not. I'm here to serve God, because in serving God, I buy another day away from the Grim Reaper. Bottom line. So helping others is the foundation stone of our recovery. And I'll tell you something. I told you, you know, when we were talking about the fourth and the fifth step, I told you that, you know, I had a history of sexual abuse and sexual violence. What woman in Alcoholics Anonymous has not? Seriously, like, you could put you all in a corner. The rest of us, you know, drunk women, we're like marks. It says, bing. Anyway, so I had a lot of damage and a lot of work I had to do on that. And I'll tell you what, do you know what I did professionally for a really long time? I worked with developmentally disabled sex offenders. Let me say that one more time. I worked with developmentally disabled sex offenders professionally. I was a victim of a sex offender, of a child molester, and God has restored me and healed me to such a degree that I could actually work with sex offenders in a professional level and have absolute compassion and love for them and not see them as being monsters, evil, and see them entirely as being children of God. Absolutely. Like, not a moment. And my husband, when I took this job, he was like, are you sure you're going to be okay with that? I'm like, I don't know. God told me to take the job, so I guess I'll find out. And what I found out was that I was absolutely 100% healed. Healed. Not a second. I did not feel unsafe for a millisecond. I absolutely had 100% compassion for these people. So how did helping a bunch of drunks, getting my jewelry stolen, my house smashed, and getting woken up in the middle of the night have anything to do with that? Because when you start working with people in the level that Chris and I are talking about, when you sit eyeball to eyeball, when the God in you connects to the God in other people, and you do this on a regular basis, you do this on a daily basis, and it becomes a part of your daily living, it becomes a part of breathing, it becomes a part of every single thing that you do every moment of every day, you start to see the world in a completely different way. You start to see God in every single thing that you do and every person you meet. And you begin to see people in terms of being children of God. You experience what it means to be a child of God. And you experience other people in terms of them being children of a loving creator. And you stop seeing them in terms of labels. And I would tell these people, and I would tell, you know, these people. I mean, they were literally out of jail, man. I'm there to patrol and control. They were monitored 24 hours a day at all times. You know, and they would ask me, they would say, you know, how do you work with people like me? And I would tell them, and I would just look them dead in the eye, and I said, you're a child of God. Why wouldn't I? You need my help more than anybody else. And these men, these grown men, would cry. They couldn't believe that I could see them as anything other than the thing. And I looked at them, I would say, I wouldn't want you to judge me by the worst thing I have ever done in my life. I wouldn't want you to judge me on that, and I won't judge you on the worst thing you ever did in your life. I will see you as a child of God, and I will see you as the person you are now, and I will love you accordingly. I will also monitor you at all times in the community and keep all children and pornographic materials away from you, because that is my job. But that doesn't mean that I don't see you as being a being. That doesn't mean I don't see you as being a child of God. And doesn't mean that I don't see you as being exactly who you are today and deserving of love no matter what it is that you have done. So the experience of doing this, having this conversation, the willingness to have our waking moments, the willingness to take people into our lives, the willingness to open ourselves up, the willingness to share with others, this experience has made me a person that I don't even recognize in so many ways, and has made me whole in a way that I could never have dreamed. I always believed that there was going to be some broken part of me. I wrote resentment after resentment inventory on why do I have to be broken for what other people did to me. And today, that is not my truth. I am not broken in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't exist. I woke up to the fact that I was whole. I didn't know that until that moment. And that's the beautiful thing about God's universe and doing this deal. Do you want
to? Sure.
Or did I interrupt your...
No. No. I'm always trying to be prepared because my ADD. I'm going to interrupt the flow of this chapter just to read probably my favorite sentence in Alcoholics Anonymous. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. That's got to be my favorite sentence ever. And let's look at that really closely. I'm sorry. It's a foreword from the 12 and 12. So you're going to be out of luck with the page.
We're such big book people that we forget you guys don't have it memorized.
We think you can read our mind and you know all the page numbers.
When you just start reading a sentence, like all of a sudden, like we just pull it up in our brain so we forget that not. Sorry.
My apologies. Anyway, the 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, if when practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable you to become happily and usefully whole. That basically says it all there. So what is our job? What is our job? An adequate presentation of the 12 steps. Bill wrote that. Said basically the sponsor's responsibility is an adequate presentation of the 12 steps. Listen, can we drive them to traffic court? Can we invite them over for dinner? Can we be their friend? Can we do all this other stuff? Absolutely. Absolutely. But what do we have to do? What we have to do is adequately present the 12 steps, because that is what's going to enable them to become happily and usefully whole and expel the obsession to drink with them. On page 96, we're going back to the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Here's another thing. You know, we do our best. We do our best with presenting this material. We do our best with the 12-step call, sharing our experience, strength, and hope, and helping to identify with the alcoholic. But sometimes they're just not ready. They cannot or they will not give themselves to this simple program. Now, what I've found through my experience is if I've done my job well, there's a real good chance I'm going to get a call sometime in the future. What I don't want to do is get desperate. Like, I have got to get this guy, you know, to Happy Hills and, and to the meeting. You know, there really shouldn't be that type of desperation. If someone is not going to work with you, you want to part on a friendly terms. You want to make sure that they have your phone number and make sure that they understand what you're about. You're about the business of helping. And if they call you, you'll make yourself available. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. So we are supposed to leave somebody in the dust if they cannot or will not give themselves to this simple program. What we're supposed to do is hand them our phone number and say bye-bye and move on to try to find somebody who is going to be willing to go through the steps with you. We're not supposed to waste our time trying to convince somebody of something that they're unwilling to do. Let alcohol convince them. You know, that's what alcohol is for. Let alcohol convince them. I don't believe anymore that it's a bad thing that an alcoholic drinks on certain occasions. Sometimes that is exactly what they need to become convinced in their own personal powerlessness. Sometimes they need to experience one more binge to say to themselves, you know what, those AAs were right. You know, I guess I need to get busy with this stuff. My relapse, what happened with me was I relapsed on the way to an AA meeting one time, and I talked a little bit about that when I shared on the first step. Do I look at, when I was real close to that experience, it was the absolute worst thing that happened to me. Oh my God, it was 7 months of gruesome, pathetic, decadent, alcoholic drinking. It was grim. I mean, I was at a point where I wouldn't even get up to go vomit. I would vomit out my window, you know, and people would be walking by the sidewalk below, and I'd be, ah! I mean, it was just gruesome. I mean, you know, I lived to experience the release of oblivion. You know, exactly what it talks about in Bill Wilson's story. You know, a couple more pints and oblivion. I was looking for oblivion in those last 7 months. So it was grim. It was grim. But what those 7 months did was they absolutely convinced me in my own hopelessness and powerlessness. So when I came back into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was willing to listen. I was willing to participate. I was willing to believe that maybe you had some information and I should follow some of that information and that and your suggestions for action, because I was out of plans. So sometimes I don't believe that it's a bad thing for an alcoholic to have a relapse. It depends. Like, if you've done your 12-step work with them and they relapse, you're probably going to be getting a phone call. You know, and maybe there's going to be a renewed enthusiasm. And then I've worked with drunks who just never seem to get it. There's a couple people in my life who are childhood friends, and I just personally, I'm not willing to push them away. When the phone rings, if they're really drunk, I'll tell them to call me back, you know, when they're sober. But I am always going to be available for these people. They are childhood friends of mine. And two of them have been relapsed. Since I've been working with them, have been relapsing for about 20 years. They'll come into AA, they'll play around in the sandbox a little bit, and you know, they'll see some of this stuff as an overreaction, and they'll go back out. You know, when it talks in the foreword about 50% of the people who came to AA and got sober at once, 25% sobered up after some relapse, and for the rest they showed improvement. I've got to believe that these two guys that are my childhood friends are in that 25% of showing improvement. At least they're not always drunk. At least they come in and they get 6 months, they get a year. Listen, that's better than always being drunk. We've probably increased their lifespan a little bit by exposing them, you know, but those people I'm just not willing to close the door on. The normal alcoholic, you know, you got to be willing to follow these directions for me to work with you. I'll be kind, I'll be compassionate, but I won't waste my time, because I'm not only wasting my time, I'm wasting yours if you're not doing this work. You know, that's a double waste of time. And I'm just not willing to do that anymore. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. How? Alcohol. Alcohol will convince him. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny another alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. Again, your time as a recovered alcoholic is very, very valuable. Use it with responsibility. You know, don't work with the people that are relapsing that you like, and not work with the person who's asking you for help that you may not care too much to be around. A lot of times the people who work with me are not exactly the people I would normally mix with. You know, I understand that, and that's not part of the deal. You know, I need to be available for the people who are willing to do this stuff. It talks about the second visit, broke or homeless. We seldom allow an alcoholic to live in our house. Over on page 98, it's not a matter of giving that is in question, but in when and how to give. So we need to be real strategic about how we apply our time with some of the people that we're working with too. It's, you know, I've had people live with me on a number of occasions. I follow this book's advice. It's never for very long. It's only for them to get a step experience, maybe get on their feet a little bit, and then it's time to become self-supporting through your own contributions. You know what I mean? That is a spiritual principle that is incredibly, incredibly necessary. I truly, truly believe this. I've worked over the course of the last 20 some years. I've worked with a lot of people who've come out of a hospital near us who have become institutionalized. These people go from one institution to the other. One, you know, welfare, food stamps, institution, welfare, food stamps, institution, and they never seem to be able to get on their feet with a job. Those people, I don't ever see them recover. You know, being self-supporting through our own contributions is very, very powerful. Listen, there's times where we can't work. There's times where we're on disability and it's very, very legitimate. What I'm talking about is living off the state. When you really do have the capacity to go out there and be productive in the world, we need to be giving. We need to be charitable. We need to be compassionate. We need to spend our time helping other people. Sometimes that can include having a job, and when we look the other way from that, sometimes we're closing the door on the spiritual life that we need to be living. Burn the idea into the consciousness of every man that he can get well regardless of anyone. The only condition is that he trust God and clean house. It talks about the domestic problem. Listen, there's been a ton of times where I've been asked to be a domestic situation advisor, to be a family counselor, you know, a lay family counselor. I have avoided that stuff like the plague. Do you want to know why? All you need to do is look back on my life to see what kind of a mess I've made of it, okay? I'm on my third marriage. You know what I mean? I lived with mom until I was 32. I mean, where would I get the balls to start, you know, start counseling on somebody on, you know, on their marriage? And, you know, like, what I can do is I can guide somebody toward the spiritual principles. Listen, folks, we don't live by advice. And if you're living by advice, get away from the people who are advising you. Yeah. We live by spiritual principles. That's what we need to live by. You know, so I'm not willing to sit in a situation and give advice that's not based on my own personal experience or spiritual principles. I'm not willing to do it. You know, there's been periods of time where people have asked me to work here, or, you know, go do there. And I've always had a reluctance because there's something inauthentic about it. If I was going to go do it, like marriage counseling, like, oh my God. Now listen, if I went through the degree and got the certifications and I understood a little bit about how it's done, you know, the Imago training and all that other stuff, you know, okay. My sponsor did that. My sponsor became basically a family therapist, and he's a really good one too. But he went through a master's program. And he learned the tools of the trade. He also brings to bear his recovery experience, which makes him a uniquely qualified family counselor. But, you know, I'm just not willing to do it with, you know, listen, I've got a problem a lot of times in discussion meetings because, you know, here's a format that's really popular in New Jersey. Okay, we're going to open up this meeting. Does anyone have a problem? Oh, my God, of course somebody's going to have a problem. Of course somebody's going to have a problem. Yeah, I got a problem. Here's my problem. Oh. And you got 20 people giving their advice on what they should do with their problem. I can't imagine a worse waste of time. I would rather be sitting in a bad Bob Newhart therapy group than to listen to something like that. Oh, my God. Yeah, well, you know what I would do? Oh, please kill me now. You know what I mean? Oh. But that goes on and on and on and on and on. Listen, we're not trained to, you know, don't tell us your problem and ask us how we should solve it. You know, please don't do that, because we'll tell you, and it'll be wrong. It'll be so wrong. You know what I mean? Oh, my God. Oh. You know, what we want to do in our meetings, folks, please be part of this, part of the solution and not part of the problem. What we need to do is we need to focus in the meetings. We need to focus on the solution. We need to be carrying our experience, our strength, and our hope. Not our opinions and our dysfunction and, you know, what stupid things happened to us today. Ha ha, funny. I need to talk about me, you know. Please. And when sharing about the recovery process, here's a good one. This used to happen all the time around my area. There were very few big book meetings in the 90s, but boy, were there some step meetings. Okay. And I remember I'd be sitting in the step meeting, and there was this one guy that was a classic. He was a classic. I don't even know why he ended up in AA. He's one of those guys that, you know, had a little too much wine at the business function, and they told him he needed help, so he showed up in AA, and he was happy from day one. So I knew he was in the wrong place. You know what I mean? He's like, yeah, I'm in AA now, and everything's great. I'm like, you are in the wrong meeting, buddy. You know, you should be an Idiots Anonymous or something, you know? But I don't judge. But every once in a while, we'd be in a step meeting, and it'd be the ninth step. And this guy would raise his hand, and he would do this. And he would say, well, I haven't done this step formally, but I'm going to share for the next 10 minutes on what my opinion is of what this step is about, you know. And he would take the meeting hostage for 10 minutes, you know, blithering about what his opinion would be on the step. I mean, let's be part of the solution, guys. Let's be the person who raises our hand and say, I'd like to share some of my experience on the ninth step. My last ninth step was this, blah, 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 blah. You know, and let's be part of the solution. Some of these meetings we're going to want to change because we're going to be completely out of our minds that they're going so far south. Sometimes it's just not our job to be the meeting police. But what we can do, what we can do is share our experience, strength, and hope, and, you know, in an attitude of compassion and understanding. You know, because there could be an alcoholic in that closed-minded discussion meeting. There might be an alcoholic by accident who wandered in there, you know? And we, you know, we need to be about the business of being being of help. Yeah. Right.
Page 98. One of my favorite sentences. I have a handful. Like I have like Carrie's like, you know, greatest hits. On page 98, middle of the page, it says says that he clamors for this or that, claiming that he cannot master alcohol until his material needs are cared for. Nonsense. Some of us are taking very hard knocks to learn the truth. Job or no job, wife or no wife, we simply do not stop drinking so long as we place dependence upon other people and ahead of dependence upon God. I think that's one of the most powerful statements in this book because it tells us exactly where our dependence needs to be. And I don't know how many times, I thought, well, you know, like, if only I had a couple extra grand, like, things would be great in my life, you know. I wouldn't be so cranky, you know. I wouldn't have to do so many 10 steps if only, you know, if only things in my life, you know, if only if I had a little bit more money or if only, like, you know, this, that, and the other thing. You know, so this is a big consideration, you know. And again, it goes back to that thing about, you know, what am I doing? Am I using things outside of me to fill the hole that I need to be placing God in? You know, and this is important as a sponsor. Like, I don't care. I will not listen. You have 5 minutes to tell me about the bullshit going on in your life, and then we're in book. I don't want to hear it. And the only reason why I let you tell me 5 minutes is so I could trap you later with whatever it is that you said. So we sit down, we read the book, and you got 5 minutes. Spit out whatever craziness is spewing in your head. So that, well, like, while we're reading this book, I can find that thing and turn it back around, and all of a sudden, whatever it is that you were telling me for, I blow you up, and I just set landmines for you, right? So I get let you hang yourself for a tiny, tiny bit, but I don't want to hear this. I want to see what your feet are doing. You know, so when I'm working with another alcoholic, and they're telling me, well, you know, I really can't, you know, meet you for that fifth step that we scheduled, and I know you gave me all this time, but, you know, I gotta, you know, do X, Y, and Z, and I gotta run some errands. I gotta go to Trader Joe's. I'm like, well, is there food in your house? Yeah. Is there anybody starving? No. Are you dying an alcoholic death? Yes. Get your ass here. Like, that's a, like, you know, seriously, like, it's a no-brainer. But how much, you know, like, we can certainly minimize, and then we start placing things above the work that we need to do. And then, and there's this other thing that I see going on, and I've been guilty of it myself, where I'm so busy doing 12-step work, I neglect my personal recovery. And then all of a sudden, I start realizing, like, I got some spiritual mojo going on here, or, like, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent, and I'm doing this and doing that because, you know, I forgot to call my sponsor for, like, 3 weeks, and, you know, I've been slacking on this, and I've been slacking on that. I'm cutting prayer and meditation short because I'm busy. So, I mean, there's definitely that balance between our personal recovery, because I can't transmit what I don't have. And when my spirit's getting sick and I'm not living in the disciplines of the 12 steps, I don't have a message that I can carry. And people aren't going to believe me because they're not going to see the recovered spirit. What they're going to see is my sickness. So when I tell them, oh, you know, you do this work and you're getting better, and they're looking at me and I'm yelling at the kids and I'm snapping at the husband, I'm kicking the dog and I'm doing this and doing that, and they're going, yeah, I really want what you have. You know, so part of a huge part of what we're doing, you know, because we're laying that kit of spiritual tools. I'm not here to put a gun to your head and make you work the steps. That's not my job. My job is to be recovered. My job is to be a beacon. My job is to be exactly that deal that we made in the third and the seventh step prayer, which basically says, fix me, God, so I can serve you. And help me be an example of your power on earth. That is my deal. That is my job. So it is my job to maintain that. It is my job to broaden and deepen that experience. That is my job to continue to grow. Am I going to start talking about theater of a lie with somebody with 3 days clean? No. Keep it very simple. Somebody with 5 years, we're going to start talking about stuff like that. We want to target our approach to where the person is at. I work with a lot of people who have 10, 15, 20 years sober who think like they know something. And I love when I get people who think they know something, because I really love it when they find out they don't know things. It's an awesome thing. It's like the balloon just goes, you know, the air just gets let right out of them. Exactly. Donnie does it better than I do. And they just, air gets right let right out of it. And people have done it to me. I don't know how many times somebody's pulled the plug on my ego, and I'm like, oh, God. You know, and I love that. I love that experience, because when that happens, I have an experience with God. When I'm busy being God, I'm busy. I can't rely on God because I'm busy relying on myself. You know, so there's that thing that we have to do, you know, and I love dealing with people who are in that spot because, you know, I start asking them questions. We start going through this book. We start having conversations, and they start realizing that they really don't know anything. You know, I put them right in the set-aside prayer. Set aside what you think you know. Let's work on this. And it's amazing to me how much people have information about the steps and very little practical experience. I told you I work with a ton of women who've done a resentment inventory and never done a sex, harms, or fear. And I'm like, really? Like, there are four inventories, man. What did you miss? Or three, depending on whether you do your, you know, sex and harms together. Like, you missed. You only did 1/4 of the experience, and you want to know why you feel like untreated. Well, that's why, because you didn't do the whole thing. All, you know, not most, not some, not 2/3, all. You know, and it talks about our domestic situations, and I do have lots of experience with domestic situations. I mean, Adam and I have been together for almost 20 years, you know, and we haven't killed each other yet. We have 4 kids. We're a recovery family. We're a unit. We do this together. We have big book meetings in our backyard where our kids run around with people who come over. There's like 7, 8 kids, sponsees, barbecues, blowing things up, big book, kids running around half naked, killing each other with sticks. It's awesome. I mean, this is the way that we live our lives. This is a part of who we are. We have movie night Fridays where people, we alternate where we have dinner, and we go to each other's houses. We cook dinner. We have our kids. We hang out. We talk about God. We have an experience. We watch a movie. You know, we do these things. This is part of what we do. It's a part of who we are. We're dragging drunks. And it's like, by the way, I'm going to bring a newcomer to the movie night Friday. Let's get together. Like, let's load that shotgun and blast them through the first, second, and third step. Have them leaving on their 4th step. Let's go. It's a community effort in our area. It's a community effort in our community. It's a community effort in our family. And it's all about that. My kids know all about this book. There are big books all over the house. There are big books. You have to, if you want to sit down, you need to move, you know, knock a big book off your chair. That is the way my house is. You know, it is the way that we live our lives. It's part of what we do. It's part of the fabric of our existence. You could not extricate the 12 steps from the fabric of my existence. It's woven in there so deeply. That doesn't mean that I'm not crazy. It just means that somehow this stuff has worked itself into how I live my life. And since this is a design for living, so that's what I do. You know, so it talks about addressing these things. And this is the most important thing. And it says, when your prospect, on page 89, it says there might be divorce, separation, strained relations, right? When your prospect has made such reparation as he can to his family, it means when he's made amends, right, to his family, and thoroughly explained the new principles by which he is living, he should proceed to put these principles into action at home. Let me explain that again. So we get it, we do some work, we explain to our family these principles by which we're living, and then we start living them. They don't need to do anything. We do it. You know, because there's that thing, and I love that. It's like, if only, you know, my boyfriend, my husband, my whatever would apply these spiritual principles to their life. And I said, well, really, are they alcoholic? No. Then they don't have to. We're the alcoholics. We're the one whose life is dependent upon a spiritual experience. They could do whatever the fuck they want. Seriously. And if you don't like that, if it doesn't meet your sex ideal, if that's not the kind of relationship with what you have, you want to have, well, that's a consideration you have to take into meditation and ask yourself, you know, are there deal breakers here? But I don't have to dictate that people around me live on a spiritual basis for me to be able to do that. The whole point of me living on a spiritual basis is that I change so that other people can do what they want and it doesn't affect me. So if I'm waiting for the people in my life to wake up and apply spiritual principles so I can stop being a jerk, well, you know, hold your breath, you know, because it ain't going to happen. And I love this. And it tells us very early on in our book about that. On page 19, it says, none of us make a sole vocation of this work, nor do we think its effectiveness would be increased if we did. We feel that the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of these principles lies in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. So ask my children, ask my husband, ask my boss, ask my coworkers, ask the people in my life whether or not I apply spiritual principles to my life, and they will tell you I do. They'll just say, that's the way Carrie is. She's funny like that. And it's the truth. I don't always do it perfectly, and they will tell you that too. But they will tell you that I try my damned hardest to do this deal. So it says that, you know, once we do this and once we realize that it's our job to apply the spiritual principles, then other people don't have to change for our comfort. You know, it says he should, back on page 98, it says he should concentrate it on his own spiritual demonstrations. Argument and fault finding are to be avoided like the plague. So, and I love this. My sponsor, Cass, used to talk about criticism. She said, we're not allowed to criticize. Ever hear that? Did you know the big book tells us over and over again that we don't criticize? Really? Because I thought criticism was my way of telling you how you needed to change so you could be better. You know, constructive criticism? My book says that we don't criticize, that we don't fault find, that we don't argue. You know, if I have a problem with something and I do the work that's necessary for me to find the truth on it and there's something that I need to communicate with you, because that's the other thing too, is I don't do work and then not communicate, because I think sometimes it's been my experience that I'll do all this work and I'll do all this spiritual work so that I don't have to communicate to you, you know, that maybe something bothered me. Because it's okay to say, ouch, but it's not okay to say, ouch, and it's your fault. I can communicate to somebody if they do something that I don't like. I have every right to say, you know, by the way, when you called me a dumb bitch, it really hurt my feelings. I just want you to know that, you know, in the future, I would really appreciate it if you didn't do that. It's okay to say that. When I bite your head off and smash in your car windshield, that's when we have problems. If I internalize it, have a resentment, and then hate you for the rest of my life because you said something that hurt my little feelings, then we have a problem. But argument and fault finding, and that means calling, you know, that means picking on people, criticizing. It's okay to communicate when somebody does something to you that bothers you. You're allowed to do that, just like they're allowed to do that to you, but we have to communicate appropriately. You ever hear of the assertiveness sandwich? Anybody ever hear of that? When you say to somebody, when you do, I feel, right? Not you make me. When you do, I feel. That's simple. So when you interrupt me in a conversation, I feel like I'm not being listened to. I know that you didn't intend to do that. I'm sure it wasn't even intentional. But I just want to let you know that so that when we're having this conversation, we can be a little bit more effective in our communication. Oh my God, it changed. Boom. You know, because I used to pray at people. You ever pray at people? God, please help me not to kill this asshole. And there's this amazing thing when you open your mouth and you speak with love. And you say, you know, you probably don't even realize that you're doing that. 9 times out of 10, I let stuff like that go. Totally let that stuff like that go because there's no point in it. I don't even need to be right. I don't even need to be having the conversation. But sometimes, and it's something that's effective in sponsorship, sometimes we need to bring things to people's attention so that they can grow. You know, so I say, well, by the way, you know, when you're ranting and raving and screaming about your husband and you're not even talking about yourself, you might want to consider that I'm your sponsor and not his. So why don't we talk about your inventory? That changed the gears very quickly. So it says that, you know, we must try to repair the damage immediately, lest we pay for a penalty or spree. So if we make a mistake, right, we fall short. We're not perfect. We must try to repair the damage immediately. Page 99, middle paragraph, last sentence. So the idea is that we talk about things, we communicate, we don't argue, we don't fault find. Little by little, the family will see their defects and admit them. This can be discussed in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. So we don't, when aggro is going on, we're not going to hash things out. There's this amazing thing, and again, this is to the wives and the family afterward, talk about this tremendously. You can do an entire weekend, you can do an entire year on these chapters. In fact, there's entire fellowships devoted entirely to these chapters. You know, I suggest people visit them. I do, often. But anyway, there's this thing, this amazing thing, when there's all this aggro going on and people are irritated, and there's this wonderful thing where you can say, which is, I'm getting heated. Could we talk about this later? Oh my God, you mean we could press pause? We can say time out? Time out. I'm getting... I'm getting heated. I can't hear you. Can we talk about this later? And then we all go to our corners. We all breathe. We all come back. And then we talk about it. We discuss it in an atmosphere of helpfulness and friendliness. So I'm not here, now I got you. Now I'm going to get you and I'm going to make you admit all the terrible things you've ever done to me. No. When we're having these conversations, when we're having these interactions, when we're having these things with our families, it's not about being right. It's not about making another person adhere to our ideals. It is not about being the actor. It's about having a healing, productive, wholesome family or human interaction. I told you the story about my daughter and losing my mind walking in on her and her boyfriend at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'm telling you, they were not playing Parcheesi. And I had a psycho mom moment, totally did. That psycho mom moment was entirely necessary to scare the crap out of my daughter, because mom doesn't have psycho mom moments, so when mom does, I must have really done something, right? After the aggro, after everything's all done, we parted, we took timeouts, we processed for a period of time, we came back and had a really rational, reasonable conversation based on spiritual principles, and we resolved the issue, and it was done. There was no argument, there was no fault finding, there was no, I can't believe you did this to me, how dare you hurt me, how could you not respect the rules of my house, blah, blah. There was none of that, because I didn't need to have that conversation, because it wasn't about me. It wasn't about my ego. It wasn't about being right. And it wasn't about putting my daughter in her place. It was about, we find ourselves in this situation. What's the way out of it? What is the solution to this? I didn't get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, but by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was there. By 4 o'clock in the morning, when I actually got to have the conversation, God took over. Well, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about these paragraphs. And it talks about, it says that, it talks about saying that this is a process, and that this doesn't happen overnight. I love on page 100. It says, "But you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen." There's multiple promises of the 12th step, by the way. There is the promises on the first page, the first paragraph, and then there's this. When we look back, we realize that things which came to us. When we look back. We realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of your higher power, and you will presently live in a new and a wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous feral. It took 6 Bloomfield police officers to put me in my second-to-last rehab. You know, I spent years trying to literally kill myself in and out of these rooms. I was a compulsive liar. I was a kleptomaniac. I like to set things on fire. you know, and I was the type of person to get drunk in the bathroom at a local AA meeting and then wander around and start sharing and rambling in a very disrespectful way. My home group at one point tried to vote me out because I had this habit of not wearing underwear ever. And I used to wear hippie skirts and dresses, and I would forget to wear underwear, and I would be like lolling in the meeting, half drunk. I was a prize. I was definitely the kind of girl you brought home to mother, right? Seriously. So I put myself in God's hands. I turned myself over to this program, this 12 steps. I put myself into God's hands. I'm currently wearing underwear, and I can vouch for that. I do not feel the need to show you visual proof. You know, high school dropout, 9 credits away from a master's degree. You know, degenerate, took 6 Bloomfield police officers to take her down, which I did make amends to them, by the way, for that. You know, I don't think I've even gotten a speeding ticket in the past decade. A highly functional member of society in my community. I placed myself in God's hands, and amazing things happened. I became somebody that I never thought I could be. I had never planned to be this person. I never believed I was going to live past the age of 21. I had no expectations. I had no ambitions. I had nothing except for a desire to drink myself to death. And I'm sitting here entirely amazed. I look in the mirror sometimes and I go, holy shit, I really am me? This really happened. Oh my dear God. And I'm overcome with absolute gratitude. I mean, weeping, gratitude when I think about who I became, and it was because I didn't dictate the outcome. I went to school to be a dental hygienist, or I wanted to go to school to be a dental assistant. I'm sorry, because, you know, I had to, like, you know, figure something out. You know, like, I was like, I guess I better go to school and do something. I went to community college to become a dental assistant. I ended up getting an associate's degree, a bachelor's degree, and almost a master's degree. I interned at the Museum of Natural History. I've had some of the best research assistantships that anybody could have gotten in the state of New Jersey who didn't go to Princeton. I was going to scrape plaque off of teeth. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's a very respectable profession. But I limit what God has in store for me all the freaking time. I say, I can't do that. And then all of a sudden, God says, well, really? I think you can. So, I mean, if it were up to me, I'd be saying, do you want fries with that? If it were up to me, you know, I'd be lolling in my own vomit or dead. Place ourselves in God's hands. It could be better than anything we could have planned. You want to wrap it up, Chris?
Sure. You know, I think it's incumbent upon some of us to have our own experience with the 12 steps, certainly, to carry the message to other alcoholics. And, I think there's also something that we need to do. We need to be about the business of keeping the meetings that we go to interesting. One of the things that happens when you start putting in decades into AA is you start getting tired of hearing the same thing all the time. I think what we need to do is we need to be about the business of helping out in the business meetings, helping out with the meeting formats, creating the fellowship that we crave, and staying here. We need to stay here. We need to not go away. Especially if we're experienced Alcoholics Anonymous members. So, listen, I want to thank everybody for coming here. I love the Fellowship of the Spirits. I really enjoyed doing this with Carrie. And, I want to thank Barefoot Bill. I want to thank Harry for asking me. This has been a blast. I love New York. I love people from New York. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.